Welcome to From the Heart with me, Dawn Lister. And today's guest is a big welcome back to Tracy Stanley, author of, you'll remember from previous seasons, Radiant Rest, which was the most beautiful book about yoga nidra, helped me to really deeply fall in love with that practice. And we have the gift of her new book, which is shortly to be released, called The Luminous Self. And it's giving me the chills just to say it out loud, because reading it, it was pretty special. I kind of read it in little snatches, Tracy. It was just the most, I kept putting it down and laying it on my chest and just breathing it in, going, oh my God, that's so powerful. I need to just absorb it for a little while. So thank you. Thank you for writing. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. And I feel very blessed to be in your presence. So thank you, Dawn.
Oh, thank you, Tracy. Tracy is coming from Santa Fe in New Mexico. And I'm just sitting on this, for those of you who can't see or just listening, I'm sitting looking at the light coming through her window, and it's so peaceful and calm. And I'm currently filming and recording from inside my wooden cabin in my car, in my garden. It's called my she shed. And if it starts to rain, because it's the UK, so rain and thunder at any time is possible, you will hear the rain start, but hopefully we'll be okay. But if not, just enjoy the ambience. So Tracy, The Luminous Self, Sacred Yoga Practices and Rituals to Remember Who You Are. And oh my gosh, what a powerful piece of work this is. It's absolutely jam-packed full of practices that we can take into our life and really work to come home to ourselves. I think that's probably how I would sum up. It's a book that brings us home to our true nature, which is something hopefully we're going to talk about today. To start with, can you just say what it was that made you want to write this book?
You know, this was a book that I've had in my heart for a while. It was actually a book proposal that I crafted before I wrote Radiant Rest.
Oh.
And at the time, what I wanted to offer were practices and a way to kind of come home, to remember who we are, because to me, I feel like spiritual practice is really, that is one of not only the goals of spiritual practice to remember who you are, but it's one of the effects of spiritual practice, even if you're not thinking of it as a goal, that all of a sudden these things start to become revealed to you. And sometimes it's a little difficult to connect the dots when the revealings happen, because we're constantly in this mode, or at least I can speak for myself. I was in a mode and continue to be in a mode of remembering and forgetting the lessons and the epiphanies and the inspirations and the downloads that come over time. So that was my original inspiration. And then after the pandemic, the kind of lockdown and, you know, just the craziness of everything that happened and the grief that was there, I just started to notice a shift, as I'm sure many people did. And it felt like there was a lack of remembering. You know, a lack of remembering how to honor each other, how to care for each other, how to care for ourselves. What I started to notice with people that I was working with as students or teacher trainees or one-to-one clients was this sense of despair. And I really felt that part of that sense of despair obviously was the condition of the world, but also the forgetting of our core essence, right? Of what is really holding everything together. And so it became more important, I think, for me to come back to this work. I think I also needed to write Radiant Rest and have that experience of writing that book and being able to be in relationship with the liminal space and my creativity. And also just to tap into a deeper sense of vulnerability and acknowledgement of grief that I think was really revealed by the early days of the pandemic.
Thank you. That's a real clear synopsis of what was going on, I think, for so many of us. Though you used the word despair, and I would say that's probably what I certainly experienced myself with my clients. That was the word, and also lost. Mm-hmm. You know, really not knowing, like, what do we, how do we come back? And we can't. And the thing is, you can't go back, can you? Not after an experience like that. We can only, in a way, go forward and hope that we move forward with connection. And one of the things that you speak a lot about in your book is connection, and we'll come to that later. It felt really important to me. I've kind of got loads of circles around that word. But before we get there, you speak about early on in the book, I think it's in the first chapter, a discussion you had with a teacher. Do you remember when they asked you the question about your true nature?
I do.
I loved it. I really loved it. So because I think it'd be really worth just unpacking that a little bit for people. Because actually, maybe if some people are listening in and they're thinking, what do you mean, you know, come back to yourself or find yourself? What does that mean exactly? Because I think for a lot of people, we just go through our life. We have our families. We have our work. And, you know, we go out the weekend or whatever we do. We have a very simple life. That's lovely. To be able to do that, but there's so much more to explore, isn't there, and internally. And I think society doesn't particularly want us to explore that, because once you know it, you aren't going to be part of a consumer-led situation for a start. It's just not going to be interested in it, so there's no benefit to kind of those that are in charge, as it were, for us to be that way. So that exploration of coming home to yourself and understanding your true self, from that story, could you share with our listeners what you were talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had just started a teacher training with a teacher that I had asked around about, because I had read a translation of the Yoga Sutras. And the Yoga Sutras really touched me. And I felt like, oh, the yoga that I'm practicing doesn't feel like it's leading me to this promise of the Yoga Sutras that's talked about. Like, no one's even weaving any of these teachings in. So I asked around, I found a teacher. That teacher asked me to do a private with them. And so I got to their office and we sat down and they asked me some questions just about my life and what was happening. And at the time I was a producer in Hollywood. So I was making these, you know, very expensive, high budget, A-list, you know, Hollywood movies, mostly action movies. And, you know, I had a very busy, successful looking life. And he sat with me and asked me questions, and then he got very quiet and felt like he was kind of staring through me. Mm-hmm. And he said, just with this like tinge of concern and almost sadness, but definitely a lot of concern. And he said, I don't know that you've ever tasted your true nature. Mm-hmm. And there was something about that question and statement together that kind of pierced through me, because so many things went through my mind as I talk about in the book. Was, first of all, how the heck would you know? Yeah, I just met you, really. Like, how would you know what I've tasted and not tasted? Two, it was like, well, what is true nature? What does that mean? And how will I know when I taste it? Where will I find it? What's the, so all of these things started to go through my mind. But I think the thing that I left with, because there's no answer really to that, there's only a discovery, is that there is a part of me that exists that I am not aware of. There is something that is covering a deeper awareness of a deeper part of myself. Mm-hmm. And the way that he used this word, true nature, it had a resonance and a frequency that felt like there was this sweetness and this brightness, and that was something that everybody in the world needed to experience, that somehow it was a birthright for us to experience just a taste.
Thank you. Yeah. And actually, when one tastes for even the briefest of moments the true nature, you can never forget.
Exactly. And the funny thing about that is that I had had a taste.
Okay.
Previously, it was the very moment that led me to yoga and meditation, but I didn't know what it was. It was a moment, I write about it in the book, where I was in South Africa and I was sitting on the balcony, and it was just a very peaceful, quiet morning sunrise. And I was not meditating, like actively meditating. I was just sitting there waiting for the sun to rise, watching the clouds over Table Mountain. And it was like this moment of stillness came, and this moment of peace and knowing. And when that happened, I was like, what just happened to me? I know something happened. I just don't know what it was. It feels like it came from inside of me, as opposed to something that was coming from an external condition. And then I started asking around. Most of my friends at that time thought I had 12 heads when I was trying to describe what was happening or what happened. But I was lucky enough to find one person who said, oh, I know what happened. Here's some books for you to read. And that's what started me on my journey of yoga. And I really feel like that meeting where the teacher asked about me and my true nature, that was the moment that propelled me into seeking, to understanding that there was something much, much more than what I had previously been looking for.
And what's so interesting, isn't it, is that often when we are seeking something other than what we're maybe experiencing in the moment, we're looking outside ourselves for something that will make us feel more at peace and more connected and at home. And for many people, actually, what they really are experiencing is a numbing of their distress that they may be holding. You speak very early in the book about some of your early childhood experiences, which, you know, I urge people to pick up the book and read, because I'm sure they'll be relatable for many people. And you connect that to the kind of the imprints that we collect throughout our life, and how those imprints mean that we kind of meet the world in a particular way, and how the practices that you are bringing forward, that you're sharing with people, can be ways to help you to overcome those imprints and to heal them. Could you speak to that a little bit, please?
Yeah, so the yogic philosophy just speaks about this idea of what is called a samskara. And a samskara is an imprint or an impression. And we have these impressions and imprints from everything that we do and everything that happens to us, and we kind of file them away as good, bad, or neutral. And so even us having this discussion right now is creating an imprint. And, you know, we just need to be aware, I think, and acknowledge how these imprints affect us. You can never kind of get rid of these imprints, right? You can never get rid of them, because they are things that happen to us. We reacted in a certain way. We may continue to react in a certain way every time we're reminded of that imprint, even though in the reality, it might not be called for. So those are things that we also need to look at. But our practices are actually helpful for us to lessen the impact of the imprints, and for us to be able to, in some of the teachings, it says that we actually are able to burn the seed, right? So we can think about a seed as something that grows into a tree or a plant that has fruit and has other seeds, and those seeds just keep getting replanted. It's like a perennial, right? So we want to stop this perennial from blossoming if it's harmful for us. And that's what these practices do. They help us to burn these seeds that eventually lead to our karma, right? Yeah. Because they become the lessons that we have to keep learning over and over. And then we never stop or pause to ask ourselves, Why am I keep learning the same lessons over and over?
Yeah. And quite often what you'll hear, and I know I've said it myself, I'm guilty of this. Why does this keep happening to me?
That, right. It's like, why does this keep happening to me? And it's not to say that we're 100% responsible for everything that happens to us, but we should definitely trace back. And there's a practice called vichara, which is this practice of kind of tracing back or deliberating to examine the origin of something. And then once we examine the origin of something, then we can start to use practices to help to shift the trajectory of our life. And I do also think that therapy and mentorship is really helpful support to have while you're unpacking some of these things.
That's so true. And I think on one of the things you do mention in your book, which I was really pleased to read, is that sometimes when you do start unpacking, a lot of stuff comes up that you need somebody to hold you with. You can't wish it away, and you can't pseudo spiritual to only think positive. I find that side of the yoga world that has been commercialized quite troubling, because actually the practices are profound and they will pull back the veil, and what's behind there is going to be challenging on some occasions, and we need a kind person to hold us in a safe place so that we can navigate in a way that feels safe. Because I think often what I've witnessed throughout the years is people becoming quite re-traumatized by going back to those experiences if it's not done correctly. So your book is such a beautiful step-by-step method of offering a practice with lots of space around it, and then opportunities for self-reflection, but also this encouragement to, you know, to seek out community, to seek out wisdom, rather than feel that everything has to be jolly, and that if you're doing this practice, your life's going to look beautiful. Because let's be honest, the world is not always beautiful.
No. And the truth for me has been, and for people that I've worked with, is that the discomfort is the portal.
Yes.
And so there needs to be spaciousness in that discomfort. And then that liminal space of being in the in-between, you know, where you're not in the past, you're not yet in the future, you're actually sitting where you are and being with what is, there needs to be a holding, right? So thank you for bringing that forward. I think it's really important for us to have a sangha and have support of somebody who is professional and trained when things get really tough and sticky.
Yeah. And then when we're doing that work ourselves, we can help each other.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the beautiful thing. I think until we are prepared to get into the messiness ourselves, we really aren't in a position to be able to be in the messiness with other people.
No, I thank you for saying that, because that I think is so true. And I think that to me is about being in a place of embodied wisdom. Right? You can read about these practices, you can read about these philosophies, but if you haven't actually applied them to your life and moved through them with time over and over and over again, you know, I can't tell you how many times I myself have used these very practices that are in this book over and over and over again.
Yeah, I can imagine. I was just, when I was reading, and I think I had the same experience when I read Radiant Rest, my first thought, which is probably a big example of where my imprints are, is, oh my gosh, I haven't got the time. And I'm working very hard, and I have been for some time, to kind of funnel my life into kind of practicing letting go. Maybe it's something about being in my 50s. I'm finally ready to kind of, I don't feel like I need to produce so much. It's more about the quality than the quantity. It feels more important. But there's a distress around the letting go. Mm-hmm. It's painful. It's difficult. But so as I was reading the book, I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is a year's work in here, you know.
Oh, good. I'm glad that you said that, because that was my vision.
Okay.
My vision is really like, let's not, you know, I'm definitely aware that we have a sense of, or this kind of thing where we power through these books that are here to help, that are here to provide tools. We power through them. And then it's kind of like, oh, I read that. Okay, let's get it to the library, or let's give it to another friend. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing this book, I really thought about, okay, what would happen if I was with a group of people for a year? Mm-hmm. And we had the spaciousness. Mm-hmm. And if someone could read just a chapter and sit with that chapter for the month, and dip into those practices when they had time to dip into those practices, because most of the practices are 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And you lived with the practices and you lived with the wisdom of your own inquiries, and then came back to the next chapter. And then you just were able to come back and forth. Oh, wait, there's a thread I want to pull from that second chapter. Let me go back to that second chapter. So this book is, to me, first of all, it wasn't written with the frequency of urgency.
Yeah, I can tell.
And I don't want people to read it with the frequency of urgency that I have to figure it out and I got to get it done now. It really should be savored and weaved into our life as a ritual of awakening that will have an ebb and flow of, oh, I do have a weekend to dive into this. And now I have a week where I'm really busy, or a month where I'm really busy, without any shame.
And there is some shame. That's interesting you said that, because I definitely feel some shame around the ridiculous busyness of my life. Because where, from the place of where I am now, I look back and just think, Jesus Christ, what were you thinking? Why didn't you say no? Why do you always say yes? And why do you always feel like you've got to be the one that holds all the threads together? And shame is probably the word. I mean, maybe not so much now, but shame is certainly the word that would have come up. But spaciousness is so important. But society does not welcome spaciousness.
No, society doesn't.
And people are, you know, if you have a gap open up in your diary, or, you know, you some more time becomes available to you, it's not uncommon, is it, for people to immediately want to pack stuff in, because our nervous system is used to that feeling adrenalized versus stepping into that self-aware space that you're offering here in this book. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of that is because there are rituals, and the rituals encourage you to slow down. Would that be correct?
Yeah. So there's a couple of threads I want to pull on this. So the rituals in the book allow you to kind of tune into this idea that life is a sacred ritual. Okay. What if I stopped thinking about the fact that, oh, I need 15 minutes or an hour to be in ritual? No. What if I look at my whole life as a ritual, and then everything is a weaving? It's an ebbing and a flowing. I'm holding everything as a ritual. Nothing is mundane. If I'm driving to the grocery store, or I'm sitting in the car waiting for my kids to be done with their soccer practice, whatever it is, in line waiting to pick up the kids, that can be a sacred moment. It's something that requires a kind of shift in perspective and shift in understanding. And it's something that we can do right now. We can just say to ourselves, I want to experience my entire life as sacred, as nothing as mundane, that everything is a portal to my awakening. And then what starts to happen is, when we have these conversations, where things happen, where you're sitting with yourself saying, oh, why do I always say yes to everything? That becomes a portal of inquiry, because we start to inquire into, as opposed to, why do I always say yes to everything and move on? It's like, oh, let me inquire to, why do I always say yes to everything? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a practice in the book that's the timeline practice, where mm-hmm. I can start to trace back to that very first moment where I remember feeling like I needed to say yes to everything. And then I can start to dismantle that. That's the thing that I'm going to work with now for the next 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start saying yes to what my heart wants. And mm-hmm. I'm going to stop saying yes to things that I know are not in alignment, or I know are going to suck up time that I really wish I could reclaim for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think then that becomes a practice. Mm-hmm.
That I know the practice you're speaking of, and I did it. I did it on a sun lounger. I read this book and another book that I was reviewing on holiday in Italy, and I read this on my sun lounger, and there was no one in the pool because Italians disappear for the whole afternoon. I don't know what they do, but I stayed by the pool and read your book, and I did that practice by the pool, and it was really profound. So I really recommend when people pick up the book to have a go of it. So much stuff came up for me when I kind of and I got to a point where I just thought, you know what, there's so much more here. I need to pause actually, because I need to sit with this little bit that's come up. And actually I'll share it because it's interesting. So I was brought up, and as our listeners will know, in a cult. I was brought up in the Jehovah's Witness cult. And I only ever remember urgency. That's the only experience I ever remember, urgency and needing to say yes all the time and to save everybody. That was what we all had to do. So disentangling, even becoming a yoga teacher, becoming a therapist, really became actually just an expression of that inner urgency. So I kind of knew that already, and I've done a lot of work on it, obviously. But when I was doing this meditation that you recommended, this practice, that's where it took me right back to. It was like, oh my God, I remember being four. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting in a green with my brother. And there was all these flats all around us. There's hundreds and hundreds of people living in these flats. And we were in this little green. I think my mum was talking to somebody. And I remember being four and looking up saying, oh my gosh, we've got to save all these people. Mm. I better get on with it. That's four. I mean, right. crazy mental. But you know, that left this profound imprint. And I really felt from the practice, the weight of what that I was carrying that in my body, mm-hmm. and how exhausting. You know, and then so because I could put it into language and I could see and feel and sense it, there was then a sense, okay, you don't have to hold this anymore. And then we had a choice. And I would say that particular practice that you offer for anyone that feels like they're maybe stuck or they're in a bit of a cycle, my God, amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Thank you for that. And that was the practice that kind of, I would say that, you know, thinking about it now, that particular practice is what led to me being able to write this book, because I sat with a question of, why do I want to hide my success? Why do I not want to be as successful as I can be? And when I did that timeline practice, it led me to that moment when I was bullied. And that was like, oh, you're carrying this forward from 30 years ago, however long it was at the time when I did the practice. And that needs to be unwound.
Mm. Wow. And you have.
And I have. And yet there's still, the seed is burnt. It's dormant. Yeah. But my practice is to keep it dormant. Because at any point, if I become unconscious and not paying attention, which can happen, right? It happens. That seed can get watered. That seed can get watered and it can become fertile. So the practices keep the seeds from growing.
There's an expression, I'm sure you know it. It's like, which wolf are you going to feed?
Yes.
And the practices, I guess, are very much about feeding the wolf that's going to bring you to the best of your, and I do believe in our karmic possibility. And I don't mean that in a way that we're punished. I just think how we express ourselves and what we bring with us when we come into this body does play out in our life in the terms of our tendencies and the people and situations that we have around us. That's really important in terms of, you know, trying to look after our potentials going forward. I would like, if it's possible, I'd like to just read a very small snippet. There's, for people who are watching, they'll say your book is like 10 zillion post-it notes.
My favorite thing to see.
I'm like, I want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about this, but we're not going to talk about them all. There isn't time. But in on page 45, where you say burning the seeds of sorrow, you've said here, repetition of the affirmation is creating new neural pathways in the brain, renewing the desire for sacred remembrance and the desire to know your true self. Notice as you move through the day when you feel the klesha arising, pause, receive a few breaths, and repeat the affirmation, either silently or out loud. Practice for a minimum of 40 days. I'd really love you to talk a little bit, if you can, around that. I mean, there's so much, even just the language, kind of the idea of receiving rather than grabbing on something. I do a similar thing when I start my class. When I first get everyone to lay down at the beginning of yoga, I'll say, your body may have stopped, but your mind will not have caught up yet. Let's just take a moment to kind of somewhere find a place where we can touch each other. And so could you speak a little bit about that? Because I found that really interesting because I don't do affirmations. They've always given me a bit of the ick. I don't quite know why, but they do. So it was when I read it, I thought, you know what, I'm going to try them again, because that felt interesting.
Yeah, I think that if the affirmation is coming from you, because you've done your own inquiry and something has been revealed to you, it has a lot more power than something that maybe somebody else has written.
Yeah.
Right. That's coming from their consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I think for this particular practice, we're looking for the antidote to suffering on page 45, and that you're kind of being that information, that wisdom is being revealed to you for you to hold. Mm-hmm. And what I would say about the receiving is that the overculture is very extractive. Mm-hmm. So we learn how to extract always. And I think that we are in that same mode of extraction in our spiritual practices. It's like, oh, I'm going to do this spiritual practice because I want to get this, or I want to manifest that, or I'm doing this for something. And I think if we can soften that idea and allow ourselves to receive, as opposed to feeling like we need to grab and we need to hold, because that there's a lot of clenching and constriction and tension. And even the idea of seeking, right? It's like you're seeking, you're constantly like this. It's like, well, what happens if I open myself to receiving? Right? Instead of taking a breath, I soften and I allow myself to receive the breath. The breath is coming. And when I receive the breath, I remember my birthright is to be in abundance. My birthright is abundance. My birthright is to be in places and with people and in ways that are life affirming. And when we're in extraction mode, I don't believe that we're really connected to the fact that we are in a place that is life affirming.
That's really powerful. Yeah. I can really get that sense of, it's the where you choose to place yourself, isn't it? You know, if you're in extracting, then you almost feel like you're in deficit and you need to grab something and you need to cling to it. And what we know, hopefully, is that the more we cling, the more we suffer.
That's right. That's right.
One of the practices you speak about, and I want to come back to connection and community, it's really important, but kind of from where we've just gone, if we discuss a little bit towards the end of your book, you speak about, you know, endings and transitions. And actually, if I very quickly just read this one sentence, we could read the whole book. We could just have a book club and read your whole book, but then no one would buy it, so let's not do that. So yeah, on page 103, Gary Craftsow. Thank you, Craftsow. He says, yoga is a practice of preparing to die gracefully. And this is under your chapter, Embracing Transition. And I read that and it's like, absolutely, that's exactly what's happening. And most people are absolutely terrified of the idea of death, especially if they've not touched their true nature or have any sense that there's something that exists beyond their ego state. And maybe we can look at that in a moment. But transitions and changes and impermanence, that's the only thing that is absolutely for certain. And yet we spend most of our time trying to hold on to this stuff that feels nice and good and comfortable, even if it's bad for us. Could you speak a little bit about that in relation to what you were writing?
Yeah. I feel like this idea of impermanence and leaning into the impermanence is really a portal, because it brings us into the liminal. And the liminal is where all the magic is. What I do sense, though, is that pre-pandemic, this was a very hard topic for people to accept. It was a very hard topic. People didn't want it. There was almost like a recoiling when I would mention this. And now what I'm sensing is that there's a leaning in, that something transitioned for us in the pandemic in relationship to death, the transition, being in the unknown, sitting in the place of uncertainty, that there's now more of an interest of, yes, this is true. If I really think about life, you know, we can think about it right now. We're closer to dying right now than we were when we started this podcast.
Yeah.
And so if we start to reframe ourselves into being with the idea that we are constantly dying, but yet there is also something within us that is constantly wanting to be born. Mm-hmm. Right. And if we can start to be in the stillness a little bit, I think that reframe helps us to live a more rich life and to be more present in the life that we have. Mm-hmm. And so yoga is this practice of preparing to die gracefully. You can think about just the physical yoga asana practice, right? We start most of the time in some sort of pose on the floor, like a baby crawling. And then we do these vigorous standing poses. And then eventually we move back down to the floor. And then eventually we're in Shavasana. It is called corpse pose for a reason. and so I think that this is really important for us to touch into. And there are several practices in the book that have varying degrees of touching into that impermanence. We can think about all of the beginnings and all of the endings that have happened in our life. We can think about our breath, the beginning of the inhale, the end of the inhale, and that pause in between, and how comfortable or uncomfortable it is for us to rest in that pause and feel like we have to grasp for that next cycle. And I think that anybody who has a garden, and I know a lot of us started gardens, right, during the heat of the pandemic, that you start to see and accept, oh, I have these beautiful flowers that are blooming. And oh, aren't they amazing? Well, I can't stay in the beauty of the blossoming, because eventually they're going to start to wither. And can I be with the withering, and can I be with the dying? And then can I notice the composting, and then what life comes from that? And so it just gives us, I think, a new perspective when we think of life as being this kind of creation, this death, and then this recreation. And we have that power within us as well. It's always happening. So it's real. I think these chapters on, and these practices of honoring the transition and embracing the transition is really important, especially as we get older. We need to be able to partner with the unknown and to explore and be in the unknown without, and I'm not saying without being afraid or without being uncomfortable, because it is uncomfortable, but to have that be a more familiar place as opposed to such a foreign place that we are just not willing to even look at it.
That's so true. And it can be such a terrifying thought, isn't it? Especially if you have never been taught, as in the West we aren't taught about, you know, what happens at death, you know, the ending of life. It's something to be looked away from, and life as we know it is to be clung to at all costs. So, you know, I think often you see people very stuck, you know, not able to let go on any level. You see that, as you said, and yet it's interesting that in a yoga class, the thing that most people love the best is corpse pose.
Right.
When you finally give them permission to, you know, it's okay to stop. We don't have to be anywhere. We don't have to do anything right now. Let's just be with ourselves as we are and watch what that looks like. I think it's a huge conversation, isn't it? This around transitions and permanence and endings. And I think it's probably one of the deepest pieces of work you'll ever do, but perhaps the most life transforming when you finally, I mean, I used to have a terrible, terrible fear of death until about 7 years ago, when I had a bit of incredible experience when I was on holiday, just walking down the street, literally walking down the street away from a group of friends who'd gone drinking, and it was 11 in the morning. And I was like, you're all mad. It's 11 in the morning. I'm going for a walk. And as I left them, I had a feeling of deep emotion, and I had a tear. And I thought, how odd to have a tear. I'm going for a walk. It'll be lovely. And as I acknowledged the tear and I surrendered into it, my sense of a individual self dissolved. And I was part of everything, universe, Milky Way. There was no me. I was just everything. And see, I lost 6 hours. I found myself in my hotel room just sitting on the floor, kind of dribbling is the word I was trying to say.
Right, right.
In a state of complete ecstasy. My husband did ask me after someone had spiked my coffee, but I don't think they had. I think I just had an experience of surrender in that moment, and for whatever reason that was where it took me. And then my fear of death went, because I knew for a fact that beyond my ego state sat my true nature, which is not alone.
That's right.
Which can't be alone, is connected to all things at all times. Just sometimes we forget, because as you said earlier, we become unconscious.
Right. And that's the beauty, right? That's the taste.
Yeah.
And that's what you were referring to, is that when you have that taste, no matter if it's a split second or if it's 6 hours, you don't forget it, especially if you have the context of what it means. And so I can make that comparison from, you know, 1995, sitting on a balcony in Tumbler's Kloof, South Africa, and having that experience, and knowing something profound happened, but not having the context and the foundations of the teachings to be able to understand. And then having a different experience, you know, 20 something years later, and having all of the context of everything that I had been studying to be able to lean into that experience and be like, oh, this is a remembering, this is a revealing, and this is something that I'll never forget. Because we are all connected. There is a divine consciousness.
There is. And don't take our word for it. Go and do the rituals and investigate.
Do the practices. Be in nature and find your own way. Because, you know, when you start doing practice and you start kind of being on this path, other ways will come to you. They will just, like you said, oh, I'm going to go off on my own. That was a practice to go off on your own, you know? So you have to learn to trust. You have to learn to trust yourself and your own inner wisdom. And that to me is really the kind of gift of the book, is really these practices hopefully lead you to a place where you can connect with your inner wisdom and learn to trust it. And learn to release a lot of the doubt that we have been programmed to be in, of not trusting ourselves, because it means that when we don't trust ourselves, we constantly have to look outside ourselves. We have to be in that external place. We have to outsource our knowing to other people.
I love that expression. Outsource your knowing. That's amazing. And that is what happens, isn't it? That's why we see so many people kind of feeling the need to change the way they appear or have certain objects or certain status or certain titles, even if the, and I mean titles as in like being in relationship or something like that, rather than just being who they are, because maybe they've never felt that sense of being okay in their own skin, in their own soul, and kind of at still enough to feel it. So there's this constant, I'll change this about myself and I'll be okay. And actually, as we know, that's our capitalist world that's very much fed and will continue to grow based on us not being good enough.
Yeah. And I also think that there's not anything wrong with being, having a title, having a this or having a that. But if you can be in the both and place, where you can be in the place of impermanence and the have the ability to let go, that if everything dissolves, that it has no effect on who you are.
Yeah.
If you lose everything, it has no effect on who you truly are. And then you're not in the place of fear. You know, and that was one of the things I didn't write about in the book, is shortly after I had that experience when I was in South Africa, is I had everything that I owned stolen.
No.
And because I was in, I was working in the country, but I had now been given all of these different books by my friend, the one friend who said, oh, I know what happened to you. Here's a few books, read these books. One of the books that I had read was Way of the Peaceful Warrior. He gave me Khalil Gibran, Jonathan Living Siegel, all these different books. But there, when my things were stolen, I came back to the car with my girlfriend after I had been picked up from the airport with everything that I owned. And I saw one of my shoes on the ground and a piece of broken glass. And I was like, oh, somebody broke into the boot of the car. They stole everything. And then I went into the car and I had been reading Nelson Mandela's autobiography, and I had my ticket home. This is back in the day when we had hard tickets. Mm-hmm. And I had my ticket home inside the book as my, using it as a bookmark. And the only thing that was left was Nelson Mandela's biography and the ticket. And I remembered the part in Way of the Peaceful Warrior when the gas station is burning down. And I was like, oh, this is an ending. And I'm done with this job. I was there as a model. I was like, I'm done modeling. This is it. And I called my agency and I told them all my stuff was stolen, all my tear sheets, my book, all my everything, my clothes. I'm going home in 2 days. I'm going to change my ticket and go home. And they're like, no, you can't go home. We're going to get everything back. And we're going to, you can't do that. You have a German client who's, you know, da, da, da. And I was like, I don't care. I'm done. This is a transition. And I was able to, just from being able to have the wisdom of reading that book and allowing that to shift my perspective slightly, something that could have been devastating 2 weeks before was an opening. And it was an opening that shifted my entire life, going back to Los Angeles, creating a new career, finding yoga. It was an opening. It wasn't an ending.
Oh gosh. Well, wow. That's amazing. And you've had, let's not share them all because we want people to buy the book, but you've had other experiences. I mean, we've gone through a similar thing. You had a yoga studio. I think you had more than one, maybe. And
yeah.
I have a yoga studio, which I've just had to completely turn around. I can't, post-pandemic, it doesn't work how it worked mm-hmm. before. And the heartbreak, the heartbreak, it like, well, okay. I said to my husband even today, if I could go back 8 years, because we grew it from a small little studio to a big studio. Mm-hmm. And then within a year, the pandemic came and then we went from classes and workshops and retreats to nothing
right.
for years, a couple of years. And then we've had to change again. And it, oh my gosh, it's visceral, the pain. But I had, fortunately, the wisdom to know, sit with it. Don't make that decision. Sit with the feeling. Allow yourself to feel all of it. Nurture yourself, and the wisdom will show you the way. And I'm just coming through it now. So when I read this part in your book about you, what happened to you then, please buy the book so you can read it. It's fascinating. I was like, oh my gosh, I can so relate. And look at where you're doing your real work. You're doing the work you were meant to do, that you were meant to give to the world. And if you'd stayed stuck and tried to make everything stay the same, you wouldn't be there.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It was another ending that was an opening. And again, going back to this idea of the discomfort of being in that liminal space, of being in the space of change, of being in the space of not knowing, of, oh, wait, but I'm a yoga studio owner. Well, no, that's not who I am. That's not really who I am. And being able to let go of who I thought I was created such expansion.
That is the word. And that's where I'm starting to feel for myself the beginning of an expansion.
Yes.
The very beginning. And I'm very aware that if I'm not careful, I could contract very quickly. So I'm going to be using your book. I'm going to be doing more of these rituals to help me stay grounded. I'd like to talk briefly, because I'm aware of our time, about you. You have some words around connection and community, and it's so important to me. And I think that's part of my childhood story. You know, a lot of it was dark, but maybe within that darkness, there was definitely a sense of community. And I've probably spent my whole life seeking to replace that with something in a more positive way. But beyond that, you know, we need each other, don't we? And you certainly speak to that in the book. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yeah, we need community. We need to hold each other. We need to hold others. And I think that if we learned anything from the pandemic, hopefully part of that was the power of community. Whether you had community around you because you were online, or you had a small pod of people, or you had the absence of community and you were really longing for community, or you maybe realized that the community that you had was not really the community that was serving you, right? So the power of community is that we can hold each other, we can reflect to each other, we can share our experiences. We can know that we're not alone. We can see how much we are more similar than we are different. And I really believe that the health of this earth and the health of everything is connected to the health of our community.
That's so true. And if communities come together, who knows what's possible?
Everything is possible.
Yeah. Separation is the thing which creates hate, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The othering that we see so much in our world, even off our planet, which breaks my heart.
You know, yeah.
Planet, then the lack of, which seems obvious to me, awareness that if we take, there'll be nothing left.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, the truth that I have found is that if you are othering other people and you are othering the planet, there's also a part of you that's othering yourself.
Yeah.
You are never going to feel whole. You are never going to feel like you truly belong. Mm-hmm. And so it's time to start reclaiming, you know, who we really are. And there's so many ways in which we can see our reflection in nature. We see it in community.
Yeah, you're so right. Tracy, is there any part of the book that you would like to read to close, a small reading perhaps to finish our time together?
Thank you for asking that. Yes. So I'm going to read the poem that begins part two of the book, which is The Portals and Practices. Am I asleep or am I awake? Let me lean into the practices that fortify my discernment. Remind me to turn my face toward the light of divine intelligence. the door to the prison cell is open. Attune me to the vibration of truth and amplify my core frequencies so I can taste my true nature. I trust that I can hold both fierce compassion and the power to wield the sword to cut through any demon. I lay down fear as I walk through the sacred portal toward freedom. I honor the transition. I reclaim my magic within the void. I only need to remember. Now let me ask again, am I asleep or am I awake?
Gosh, that's beautiful. And so much more beautiful because you read it.
Thank you.
Thank you. When you buy Tracy's book, you also get a code to our website, which gives you some of the practices that you can listen to at home. And you have the same thing with Radiant Rest, and I have them downloaded onto my phone. And often I usually have a yoga nidra nap in the afternoon between clients. So quite often we have a little time together, Tracy.
I love that. In the liminal space, we're hanging out.
We're just hanging out. I'm like, hi, I'm just getting set up for yoga nidra. Tracy's download. So yes, I mean, so many reasons why to buy the book, apart from, you know, just because it's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. As always, it's been insightful and soul enhancing, and a real kind of moment to pause and remember why we're here. That's what it feels like. Remember why we're here and why we're here together at this time. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such an honor.
Thank you. So listeners, please do us the honor of leaving a review. I hate doing this bit. We have to do this bit. We need a little review. It brings us up the rankings and it helps other people to hear the wisdom of the words of Tracy and all the other wonderful, kind individuals who come and talk on the podcast. Leave us a review, share with your friends, and please take the time to slow down enough to listen and take part in some of these practices. Have a beautiful day.